Hello and welcome to the first podcast for Supreme Bystander. My name is Kara Gallagher.
And my name is Jim Cole.
Welcome, Jim. Today we're going to dive into a recent case. It's called Shelby County versus Holder. This was a case that was argued February 27th of this year, 2013. Was decided fairly recently, June 25th of 2013. It's a case that certainly got a lot of attention in the press and the news from the president, from Congress, and from lots of average citizens. So we thought it'd be a good case to dedicate our first podcast to. So welcome and thanks for listening. Jim, you want to add anything right out of the gates here, or should we jump into the facts of the case?
No, I look forward to talking to you about the case, and welcome to everybody that's going to be listening.
Excellent. So let's run down the facts. That's always a good place to start. Let's begin with the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which is really what this case centers around. This was a piece of legislation that was enacted by Congress in light of the pervasive efforts by certain states, specifically the Civil War Confederate states, since the Reconstruction era amendments were ratified, to deny minorities the right to vote. Some of the states and cities in the Voting Rights Act include the Carolinas, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, Virginia, and of course Alabama, which is where this case comes out of. Shelby County is located in Alabama. Notable sections of the Voting Rights Act, certainly Section 2 is one that we want to cover, and that says banning any standard practice or procedure that results in a denial or abridgment of the right of any citizen to vote on account of race or color, and sections 4 and 5, and that's really what was at stake in this particular case here. Section 4 says, this provides for what's called the coverage formula, and that's a vocabulary phrase that you're going to certainly hear us refer to a lot in our discussion today. This section says the coverage formula, defining the covered jurisdictions as states or political subdivisions that maintain tests or devices as prerequisites to voting and had lower voter registration or turnout in the 1960s and 70s. Discrimination in polling places in the South took forms like requiring African Americans to take poll tests or literacy tests, perhaps paying fees in order to vote, or requiring that they be able to write actions that were clearly done to disenfranchise voting to maintain a hold on representation. In those jurisdictions, Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act says that no change in voting procedures can take effect until approved by federal authorities in Washington, D.C. Specifically, either the Department of Justice or the U.S. District Court in Washington, D.C. Would need to be essentially advised or, you know, gotten the authority from before any kind of changes were to occur in any of those jurisdictions mentioned. This practice is known as what's called preclearance. This is another term you'll hear us use a lot. It's basically like getting their approval before any action were to take place. Not long after the voting rights legislation was enacted, incidentally, I should mention a little shout out to one of the original authors of the legislation is Illinois' own Senator Dirksen. South Carolina tested the constitutionality of this landmark civil rights legislation. This is a notable precedent worth talking about. It's South Carolina versus Katzenbach. And Jim, I think I'll turn it over to you. You want to talk a little bit about the first test to the Voting Rights Act?
Well, South Carolina versus Katzenbach is a case that comes before the court in 1966, a year after the Voting Rights Act is passed. And they're basically challenging that idea that they have to get preclearance from the Justice Department or a panel of judges in order to make changes to their voting laws. And South Carolina is unsuccessful in their challenge. And the Supreme Court upholds the idea that the discrimination based upon race is pervasive in many of the areas where the preclearance is a requirement.
That's true. I just want to point out a line or a quote from that decision, which is also, I think, worth mentioning. It says, such an uncommon exercise of congressional power like this legislation could be justified by exceptional conditions such as the blight of racial discrimination in voting that had infected the electoral process in parts of our country for nearly a century. I think what we should probably dedicate some time to next, Jim, if you would kind of walk us through how many times the Voting Rights Act has been reauthorized and for what reasons?
Well, the 1965 law, which is the original authorization, had a five-year expiration date. And it, as you had mentioned, was based upon discrimination based on race from the 1964 election. The next time it comes up for reauthorization is 5 years later, and that is in 1970. And they based the reauthorization based upon a standard of discrimination from the 1968 election. The 1970 law also has a five-year expiration. And 5 years later, once again, Congress revisits their ability to pass laws, basically making sure that there is no discrimination based on race, in 1975. In 1975, they base their metric or whether or not there is racial discrimination taking place in these elections based upon the 1972 election. And at that point, they give it a seven-year expiration date. And in 1982, they once again revisit reauthorization. And this time it is passed, but they give it a 25-year expiration date. So we don't revisit it again until 2006. One of the interesting things that we talk about is the 1982 and the 2006 laws that are passed extending the Voting Rights Act for protracted periods of time, they never revisit the metric again past the 1972 election. So this is something that the majority opinion will take up in their opinion, the idea that they're really basing metrics based upon 41 years ago.
And that was that issue here. I think there was a lot of discussion after the decision came down about that metric, and that's certainly something we're going to dedicate some time to. I guess, would it be accurate to say that what changed each time the Voting Rights Act was reauthorized was the length of time the act was to hold as law, but what didn't change was basically anything else, specifically the preclearance requirement. Would you agree?
Well, I would agree that, you know, Section 5 has never changed. The idea that places where there is pervasive discrimination, there is a requirement of preclearance. What we're visiting here in this case is the Section 4. What is the metric? What is the bar? What is the barometer? What is the hurdle that has to be achieved in order to not fall under the preclearance? And that's Section 4.
Okay. I think in a lot of cases it's important to keep that aspect of this case in mind and understand the linkage there between Section 4 and Section 5. You know, as whatever happens to Section 4 will no doubt impact Section 5. So why don't you go ahead, Jim, and talk to us about the issue and how this case ended up coming down in the court.
The issue in the case is basically the question of whether or not the preclearance requirement reauthorized by Congress in 2006 was a violation of the U.S. Constitution. And basically what the court is looking at is this reauthorization that takes place in 2006 is really based upon numbers or a set of statistics from 1972. The Congress makes a reauthorization in 2006 for 25 years based upon a 1972 standard. So that's basically what we're looking at in this case and what the court is going to address in their majority opinion, is whether or not the preclearance from 2006, the reauthorization in 2006, is a violation of the U.S. Constitution.
Okay. So let's get into the decision. You want to talk a little bit about who authored the decision, what the vote count was, and give us, in a nutshell, the reasoning behind the decision there.
So basically, in a nutshell, it's a 5-4 decision. Chief Justice John Roberts signs the opinion to himself. And basically what John Roberts says is he does address the three sections that you laid out for us in your introduction. Section 2, he addresses that almost right away. On page 3 of the opinion, he says Section 2 is permanent, applies nationwide, and is not at issue in this case. Basically, Section 2 being the nationwide anti-discrimination clause of the law. Section 5... he also says is not at issue in the case either. You parents, as long as you could prove that, as they said in 1966, the South Carolina versus Katzenbach case, as long as you could prove that there's a pervasive discrimination. Section 4, though, is where the majority opinion takes issue. And the majority opinion is Chief Justice Roberts, Associate Justices Alito, Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas joining him in that opinion. And basically, Section 4 is where the majority opinion takes issue. The problem that the majority sees is that the preclearance reauthorization in 2006, based upon the 1972 metric, is not a current is not enough to demonstrate that there is a current burden that would demand what they what the court had called in 1966 an extraordinary measure.
Okay, so we're there are just those kinds of conditions, those numbers, and certainly I feel like the Chief Justice did have some fairly hard-hitting evidence if I look back in his opinion, and you might have that in front of you there that said, look at these factors today just don't exist like they did back then when this legislation was first designed.
Right. Well, Judge John Roberts, in his opinion, uses on page 15 of the opinion, you could see some of the statistics to show that at least according to one standard or metric in all of the reauthorizations, and that's voter registration. In Alabama in 1965, African American voter registration was at 19.3%. In 2004, it was at 72.9%. In Georgia, 27.4% African American voter registration in 1965, and in 2004 is 64.2%. In almost every single, and then he goes on to look at statistics from Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, Virginia, just as a sampling in terms of how much voter registration has changed. In almost every single one of these samples, voting registration has almost universally more than doubled. And in some cases, we see almost seven times the amount of voter registration from 2004 to 1965. So he does support his opinion that the metric that we're using in 1972 is dated material.
That's true. I'm going to get into the dissent now, unless you want to add anything else about the majority opinion.
I just want to point something out very, very quickly. So the Voting Rights Act really is based on history. And the Voting Rights Act, when the legislation was passed, looked at a history of discrimination that the majority, any clear-thinking person, looks at these statistics and say that there is absolutely pervasive discrimination going on when it comes to voting rights. But what John Roberts does in the opinion is he says, look, history doesn't end in 1965. It goes on to do. Their burden now is to look and see if the metric that is set from the 1964 election, the 1968 election, the 1972 election still applies to our current election process.
So let me jump into the dissent here, which was authored by Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And, you know, she certainly acknowledges the points that you made about progress, and progress being we see leaps and bounds, many more formerly disenfranchised classes of individuals who are registering to vote, who are voting, who are also taking part, you know, wildly, I would say, maybe in certain parts of the country. In our elected positions. But she stops there and says that the progress that's been made is not enough to stop it and sort of continue on with, you know, leaving it up to Congress to design something else. Just because the numbers have increased doesn't mean we should necessarily end everything right now and have to kind of scrap it and redo it. She delivered what I would call somewhat of a fiery dissent for a personality like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I suppose, if you could call it fiery. I happened to be in the court that day to hear her dissent read from the bench, which is definitely a treat if you're ever in the court. That's a really neat experience to listen to a dissent from the bench. She was joined by Justices Breyer, Kagan, and Sotomayor, typically considered to be the sort of liberal bloc of the Supreme Court. Congress was charged, in her opinion, with protecting the voting rights of groups of people who had been historically denied either the access or the right to vote in the years following the reenactment of the Reconstruction Amendments, specifically, as we've been talking about, the 15th Amendment, and answered that charge with overwhelming consensus, not once, but as we've seen, three times, four times. Ginsburg and the three other justices upheld the constitutionality of Section 4 and 5 for two reasons, and I'm going to get into those in a sort of nutshell here. First, continuance of the Voting Rights Act would facilitate completion of the impressive gains thus far made, and second, continuance would guard against backsliding. The court today terminates the remedy that proved to be best suited to block that discrimination. Basically, she sees striking down the constitutionality of both sections of the Voting Rights Act as being on par with perhaps throwing the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak. Her quote, and this is directly from her dissent, throwing out the preclearance when it has worked and is continuing to work to stop discriminatory changes is like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you're not getting wet. The crux of the dissent, I think, is that if these two sections are tossed or found unconstitutional, what barriers exist in places where decades of disenfranchisement have occurred, no longer in the forms of poll taxes or literacy tests, which we don't see or hear about today at all, but in real second-generational forms of disenfranchisement, of discrimination, to protect this class of individuals. Speaking to the reality of these second-generation forms of voter discrimination, Ginsburg cites eight examples of recent, as recent as like 2006, I think, cases where backsliding is happening. We don't even need to look far beyond the dissent to find more recent examples in the news, cases of voter discrimination like the elections of 2000, 2008, and 2012 all had specific examples. Denying people from voting because of voter ID laws and moving polling places at the last minute, these are all happening right now. And the fear is voter access could get worse before it gets better if these protective sections are not constitutionally upheld. Showing deference to the legislative powers Congress had and employed when they voted to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act, Ginsburg acknowledged that Congress had all of this information, all the information that you just ran through and the numbers, that data was before them when they voted most recently in 2006. By numbers that are fairly shocking, I might add, 390-33 in the House of Representatives, and 98-0 in the Senate, numbers seemingly unimaginable today on any matter of legislation in both houses. They knew in 2006 the changes in voter turnout from the 1960s and 70s to today. They knew tests no longer existed in the nine states and several localities, and yet they still voted to uphold the current formula. A few things to probably say about that.
Let me ask you this. First of all, obviously it has overwhelming support in the House of Representatives, as you cited. 390 members of the House of both parties voted for the Voting Rights Act reauthorization in 2006, 98-0 in the Senate, by wide bipartisan support. Now, it's hard to imagine any law that is named after Coretta Scott King, Rosa Parks, as the 2006 reauthorization was named, many people voting against this, but that goes right into almost the point that Roberts is making. Perhaps the political branches cannot, you know, take a look at this law and look at it objectively and take a look at it and kind of take out the idea that can politicians address what some are calling a racial entitlement, and are they able to actually look at that through, you know, lenses that aren't in some way looking out for their own political future by voting for a law that is really based on 1972 numbers. What do you think about that?
I mean, that's certainly something that I considered, thinking, you know, yeah, is it political suicide to vote against something called the Voting Rights Act? You know, I mean, you're very hard pressed to find any numbers that match those numbers on any other legislation. I mean, I can't even think of anything off the top of my head, although I'm sure there's something close. Given the polarization, given the animus that exists, I can't help but think that it's not necessarily going to stop several senators. And in 2006, I'm sure there are many that questioned it, and no less, for whatever reason, they decided to vote to support it. And I just cannot help but think that it's, you know, certainly a consensus there, and that is overwhelming enough. I see how in this case where Ginsburg finds that to be fairly compelling, it's enough for her, and it was enough for the other four.
But are we to assume that 2006, the Congress was even less partisan than they are today? In 2006, you had a midterm election, 6 years into a presidency. You had Republicans lost control, essentially, of the House of Representatives and the Senate in that particular election. So I think it's a little bit of a myth to say, hey, in 2006, it was this, you know, kind of kumbaya moment in the Senate and the House, and we don't have that now, so we can't pass it. I think she's going against her point. When Justice Ginsburg says, hey, there's overwhelming support for this. Well, if there's overwhelming support for the Voting Rights Act in 2006, if there's overwhelming support that you can't vote against it, whether you actually believe in it or you think it's political suicide, this does not end both sections of the Voting Rights Act. I think that she almost states that in her opinion, you know, a number of times. It is a declaring unconstitutional one section, the section that says that the metric from 1972 is too old and it is too dated. All they are saying is you still have preclearance requirement. You just need to set a new metric. It doesn't terminate the remedy. That is a complete fallacy about this case. As Justice Ginsburg calls it, a termination of the remedy, it's not. The remedy of preclearance is still there. We just need a new metric. Congress is good.
No, I'm sorry to interrupt you there, but I think Ginsburg sees the writing on the wall, and she's really not wrong. You spoke to it already, the animus that exists currently in Congress, which was it's probably no better or worse, really, than it was in 2006. But no less, if you bounce that ball, essentially, back to Congress, which is what you're asking, what the majority is asking, what you are speaking of, to say, okay, rewrite this so that it's more in line with contemporary metrics, contemporary numbers, et cetera, then who knows how long that's going to take? I mean, I think she and the other three who agreed with her saw it as almost, you know, basically akin to climbing Mount Everest, getting Congress to agree and pass this legislation again. And that's why there's this fear, like, listen, if we don't have at least something in place here,
well,
what protections are there?
It's not only the majority, I think, that agrees with it. I think if we read the 15th Amendment to the Constitution, I think that it's pretty clear who has the power to do this, and that's Congress. And if they choose not to do it, then the voters, if it is such an issue that has galvanized the nation, then the voters will hold them accountable in the next election. I think that a lot of these situations, we try to find almost the easy remedy. Well, the easy remedy is to not revisit the numbers again and just keep passing it based upon numbers from 40 years ago, 41 years ago. There have been multiple elections between then and now, midterm elections, presidential elections, gubernatorial elections. We could find any new measure. I think that any reasonable person, even the majority in the case, says we know that there's discrimination today. We're not blind to that. But what we need to figure out is how much the discrimination is today and what areas are affected by the discrimination. In two of the areas, the states that are covered by the preclearance under the standard, they've been covered for over 25 years, Arizona and Alaska. There has never been a Section 2 violation even brought a charge even brought against them. So the metric that we're looking at has an assumption that racism is as pervasive today as it was in 1972. If that's true, then let's set the metric based upon one of the more recent elections. And will states and counties and cities still be bound by that? Perhaps they will. But if they're not,
it makes me think of Justice Breyer during the oral arguments had an analogy that, you know, where he was kind of teasing this issue out, and it sets up a good question about this, you know, this idea of, I think he calls it a weed or a, you know, disease of discrimination. It may be pulled and therefore no longer visible, but the root, the disease, still exists. So to that extent, doesn't there need to be perhaps a mixture of maybe old and new remedies to fix the disease of voter discrimination?
Absolutely. Let's use the remedy that they used.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say, yeah, I agree that, you know, we shouldn't have weeds in the garden and we shouldn't have discrimination in voting based on race. I absolutely agree with that. And a reading of the Chief Justice's opinion, you'd find that or anybody reading it would find that the five justices on the court in that majority opinion thinks that this is a good idea to get rid of discrimination. What we're looking at is the fact that, do we have weeds today in the garden? Yes, we do. And how do we get rid of those weeds? Why don't we use the metric that was used in 1972 and SEP, let's apply it to the 2012 or the 2008 election? I don't understand how that's controversial.
Well, I think if maybe nothing else, there is some perhaps comfort to people who are, you know, afraid, maybe as I was kind of, you know, inferring that Congress, you can't expect them to get anything done expeditiously, certainly right now. However, in this particular case, it sounds like it's definitely it got the attention of Eric Holder right away. Within hours after the case came down, he issued a statement, the president issued a statement about it, and we've since seen, this is, you know, barely even a month ago that the decision came down, Congressman Lewis, John Lewis, the great civil rights activist,
Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner from Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's
also
that's
proposed legislation on it as well, the Republican.
That's true. So they are looking to move to reform the requirement, the metric. So, you know, so whether that happens, though, of course, is, I think, still what is maybe a bit unsettling to people, and that's what brings up the controversial nature of it. So. So anyway, I'm sorry, I interrupted you before, and you were going to say something before I jump into another point here. Go ahead, if you remember what that point was.
No, I was going to make the point that, you know, I do. I think the point that I was going to make was that, you know, while it is something that obviously the president finds important to speak about, and the attorney general, who's a party in this case, Eric Holder, it's Congress's responsibility to pass this law. Should Congress do it? I think any clear-thinking person, whether it's about voting rights or whether it's about politics, the Republican Party cannot look like they don't care about African-American voters. It looks bad to everybody. So the politics behind this is that I think Republicans should be jumping up and down to try and get a law passed that corrects the Section 4, the Section 4 law. Provision that was declared unconstitutional. Everyone benefits from that, more people voting.
Agreed. I see that as something Democrats care about too, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's a benefit to be had by both political parties to have more people voting. And the idea that, you know, the Republican Party would simply just stand in the way of this, I think that that's not how it's playing out. You see Jim Sensenbrenner, as I mentioned before, congressman from Wisconsin, John Lewis, as you had mentioned before, Democratic congressman from Georgia. They are at the forefront of trying to get a new Section 4 passed with a new metric, and I think that that would, you know, alleviate some of the issue here. The thing that I think many people try to do, though, in some of these cases is they try and set up, you know, a system, and they try and say, well, the Supreme Court has the power to do X and Y, and the Congress should have the power to do, you know, Y and Z. It's clear that the Constitution has given this back to the Congress. The Congress is abdicating their responsibility if they do not make sure that there is no discrimination in the voting place when it comes to race. As I said, the 15th Amendment clearly charges the Congress with that responsibility, so they should do their job. This case is actually more than just about voting rights as well. It's about a number of other things also. The case goes into the idea of states' rights, which is kind of a loaded term when we talk about, you know, racial discrimination. But in terms of the way that the founders actually envisioned the government, both in the Constitutional Convention and in the first proposal of amendments made by James Madison to the House, the idea that the federal government would be able to nullify, before a law takes effect, a law passed by the states, was discussed and debated, and it was completely rejected. So this also, we also had the issue of states being treated unequally. Clearly, states were viewed as somewhat sovereign entities in some regards, especially when it came to voting rights, and this law, there is a question about that, at least to be explored by the majority opinion. Whether we agree with it or not, that's another issue. But there's a lot of issues circling around this particular law and how this will play out in terms of the powers of Congress and the role of voters when it comes to their rights in the polling place.
Right. I think it's it makes me think of, you know, sort of, I don't doubt that this issue came up in 2009 when there was another case precedent that's probably worth mentioning, and that's the Northwest Austin utility case, where I don't know if you would agree, but you know, I think there is some opinion that maybe, you know, the Congress or the court kicked the can a bit when they said to them back in 2009 that, you know, there really essentially wasn't a ruling on that case, but that, you know, there was concern that the metric wasn't in line or on par with contemporary standards. And Congress didn't do anything about that after the 2009 decision came down. And here we are, you know, just a few short years later and now in the situation. So to the extent that, you know, Congress hasn't been moving fast enough to heed the court's warning, that, you know, that's certainly another issue that circulates this case. But, you know, I just want to make one final point here that came out of the dissent, and that it hasn't been brought up yet, which is to say that, you know, there was a question that Sotomayor raised during the oral arguments about sort of, you know, generally, rhetorically, has the South changed? And, you know, if there are, I would say, issues in localities where voter discrimination is still happening, it's not as if those states and localities were stuck with preclearance requirements in, as Scalia loves to say all the time, perpetuity. There is a bailout clause that would extract them from the requirement if they met the following criteria I have here. They must not have used a forbidden test or device, nor failed to receive preclearance, or lost a Section 2 suit in the 10 years prior to seeking the bailout. All of those things, I mean, I think we could argue over whether or not we think they're doable or not, but, you know, the proof is obviously in sort of the examples where Virginia has 24 counties and 7 cities that have successfully bailed out. So clearly it's possible to meet this bailout requirement, and yet now that the Section 4 and Section 5 has been ruled unconstitutional, that, you know, we don't have that.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is possible for them to bail out, but the bailout provision still leaves us with the assumption that the state or the locality is discriminating, and then the state or the locality has to prove that they're not. That's clearly not the way that the founders envisioned the relationship between the federal government and the state government, especially when it comes to the ability to set up the voting system within the states. So while the bailout is, you know, a ray of sunshine or a ray of hope for different states or localities, you know, it's not the catch-all. You still fall under preclearance. And some of the places that fall under preclearance, it seems to defy logic. Certain counties in California, certain counties in New York State, including Manhattan. I mean, I don't think that there is, you know, anybody that could say today that there's this rampant, pervasive discrimination of minority voters in places like New York City.
Yeah, that was one surprising aspect of, you know, looking at the localities that are covered. There are areas or states that you wouldn't traditionally, you know, think of when you think of the history of, you know, racial discrimination in the polling places. I do want to make one point that you haven't said, which is, you know, I suppose that, you know, if you're thinking about as an individual or some sort of class organization of people who still want to pursue a discrimination, you know, action suit or lawsuit of some kind, that, you know, that is still available. People can still challenge things right, like voter discrimination in polling places. It's just that it does make me think
well,
of
Section 2, that, right.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say Section 2 is still an option if someone feels like they're being discriminated against or a group feels like they're being discriminated against. The only problem with that, I think, as Ruth Bader Ginsburg points out in her opinion, is the fact that the discrimination has to have taken place in order for them to file a lawsuit. So it's kind of like an after-the-fact type of idea, which is a pretty good point in the dissenting opinion.
Yeah, her quote is that voting suits are unusually – onerous to prepare, sometimes requiring as many as 6,000 man hours spent combing through registration records in preparation for trial. Litigation has been exceedingly slow, in part because of the ample opportunities for delay afforded voting officials and others involved in the proceedings, which is exactly what you said. You know, you can't, you file action after an election happens, and let's say you win or you're found to be, you know, correct, and you can't go back and rewind time and put your votes. So, you know, people are, I think, less inclined to actually pursue those. So,
well, that's why I think that that's why I think it was a good decision in that the majority left in Section 4. They didn't throw out Section 4. They just forced it back to the branch of government that will now have to debate it. And I think that that's, you know, in keeping with what Larry Kramer calls, you know, the idea that everything will funnel back to the public square. Everything will funnel back to the place where we will debate these issues. So sure, the Supreme Court could have come in and said, here's the way it's going to be, X, Y, Z. But what they actually did was they, as you mentioned before, the phrase you used, they kicked the can back to Congress. They said to Congress, you have a job here and you need to do it. Now, one of two things are going to happen. People are going to be so galvanized that they will force their congressmen and congresswomen and their senators to act on it, or they will be lethargic when it comes to or apathetic to this change, and they will do nothing. In that case, then the Congress will probably do nothing. But the option is still there. It's been kicked back to the people, essentially.
Absolutely. And, you know, I just want to say that that's kind of been a big sort of a goal of these discussions here, of the discussions that we have, which is to say, you know, the decision, the role of the court, the decision of the court is not the end, you know, stop. Nothing else happens. It's okay. It's a question that's been answered, and now what actions will be taken by the other branches of government, by the state involved, by the people, whomever it is, so that people don't look at these actions or these opinions and say, well, I guess we're, you know, screwed in some way. There are things that you can do, so we do try to, you know, tell people, okay, here's what could happen, here's what happens next, so that people don't feel, you know, sort of blocked out by a decision.
Right.
I also want to take a second to start thinking about how we would, you know, teach this. You and I both have backgrounds in teaching and education, particularly of constitutional law. That's where our connection started from, and that was a great shout-out you had for Professor Larry Kramer at Stanford. And I want to just make a quick plug for his book, which is a fantastic look at that whole idea you were talking about of, you know, these constitutional ideas and beliefs in the Founding Fathers. And it's called The People Themselves. It's a great read. But how would you teach this case? I mean, how would you think about these issues embedded within this case?
Well, I think there's a number of ways that you could teach this case. You could teach it on the basis of, you know, the state's rights. You could teach it on the basis of federalism. You could teach it on the basis of the powers of Congress. You could teach it on the basis of, you know, voting rights. You could teach it as a continuum in talking about voting rights. I think that there's any number of ways that you could take this and put it into the classroom and have students that – engage students about, you know, about these topics that are still timely and still very relevant to us.
I agree. I think
How would you teach this in a classroom?
Yeah, no, I was going to say, I think one of the things that really rings true for me is the idea, the concept of federalism here, because I feel like, you know, as a person, when I'm just trying to talk to people or young adults about what is federalism, and you put down a definition, you know, on a piece of paper or on the board or whatever, it's very hard for, I think, the average person and young adults to kind of get an idea, really understand, comprehend what federalism is. And so the best way to understand it is to really look at it and right. get into an example of this struggle. And there are so many contemporary issues where you can kind of put yourself into these examples and see. And this is a great example. Here you have, you know, the federal government saying one thing and certain states saying something else, and you've got this, you know, tension between the two, this conflict that arises. Both have these great interests and principles in mind and people in mind and the goodness that comes from both sides, but have very different views and opinions on how exactly those that particular matter, in this case, access to voting rights and perhaps righting a historical wrong, how exactly that's supposed to work. And this is a great example of that. And there are a lot of other issues that you could use to, you know, sort of throw people in the middle of that struggle of federalism, but it's a great way, I think, to see that. Also, of course, just checks and balances in general, like what happens after the court issues their decision. Immediately, states like Texas mobilized to get rid of, I think they were able to end an injunction that was holding off or preventing people from being able to vote without one or two forms of ID, and that was a reaction to the court's decision. Or the way that Eric Holder and Barack Obama reacted, or the way that John Lewis and Sensenbrenner are reacting now, and seeing sort of really the flow of those checks and balances. It's a great opportunity to see that.
The court, I think, yeah, those are really good points. I think that the court really also provides us with, whether it's this issue or any other issue, two really, really well thought out points of view on an issue that we may be passionate about. And sometimes I think it's very rare when people talk about an issue that they're passionate about to see the other point of view. And I think that by reading both Justice Ginsburg's dissent and Chief Justice Roberts' opinion, as well as Thomas's concurring opinion, which is also quite interesting, you really get a flavor for how you could have intellectual debate without reducing your opponent to, you know, a caricature. And I think that that's something that students and all of us, I think, would find valuable in talking about things like public policy or rights or, you know, the role of government. And I think that those are really important things.
I agree. Well, I want to thank you for joining me in the discussion. We will be sure to have more of these on a lot more cases coming up down the road. This is just the beginning. And encourage people to go back and check out the website and see what else is there. Lots of articles, lots of, pictures and other access points for furthering interest on constitutional matters. Thank you very much. Again, my name is Kara Gallagher.
And my name is Jim Cole.
We'll see you guys next time.